Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
And we're transitioning the podcast to the new Chewing Ice ASMR channel. If you don't know what ASMR is, it's this, like, when you hear... How do you describe it? It's enjoyment. Well, ASMR channels are YouTube channels where people do things with subtle noises really amplified.
Some people find certain noises incredibly soothing, like it actually sort of activates like the pleasure center of your brain. I'm sure I'm completely wrong in the neurology of it, but there's something about certain sounds that is incredibly pleasing. Anyway, I have a friend named Melissa who has an ASMR channel, and her thing is opening soap packages.
And like, that sounds like really weird. And there's nothing like, there's nothing creepy about it.
No, it's just,
it's just people enjoy the sound of.
And you know, the funny thing is I like tuned in because I was curious. Like, she's like, this is my YouTube channel. And I actually listened to it for like, watched it for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. It was like incredibly mesmerizing.
It's like listening to like a fireplace, like a fire in a fireplace, the crackling, the popping, the noise. It's sort of a
or
white
like wind
noise.
Or like raindrops falling off of an eaves, right? Or something
like a noise generator, but not white noise, but like a noise like or babbling brook or stream. There's like certain sounds that are soothing, although our ASMR channel would be ice chewing, which would be the opposite of soothing for a lot of people.
This brought to you by the fact that I have, yes, a very bad habit of chewing ice that drives my family crazy.
And a family of people who have misophonia. Certain noises drive them crazy. Anyway. So you get a little taste of our...
Welcome to Sunday night at the Bettinelli house.
Woo! A little taste of our pre-show pitter-patter. Patter? Not pitter-patter. Pitter-patter's feet. Patter is just talking.
The pitter-patter of little feet is always relevant here.
That's ASMR. Anyway, moving on. Wow, this is going to be a weird one, folks. So what did we do this week? So I had an interesting experience this week. I went out to a restaurant for the first time since the pandemic began. Now, I've been in restaurants, like picking up takeout, but to go to a place and sit and drink and eat food without a mask, and it was really weird. And it wasn't with you. It was a meeting. So our Cub Scout pack had the committee meeting, and we've been doing it via Zoom, but it just doesn't work as well. I mean, not everyone has a facility with technology. Mm-hmm. Not everybody's tech is really up to par. It can be like some people don't understand that you can't do it from the beach while the kids are screaming behind you and you're waving the phone around and there's the wind noise.
Uh-huh. That sounds nightmarish.
Yeah, it was. So we're like, oh, well, let's get together and do this. I'm like, okay. So there we were, eight of us in a room at this pub down the street with, you know, a beer and food and no masks. And it was kind of, I don't want to talk too much about the whole mask, no mask thing. It's all controversial these days, but I try to be safe. I try to abide by the rules. It felt a little weird to be like, it's one thing to be not masked around family that I'm living with, but to be like within a few feet of other people. And just because we're, I don't know, eating meal, it's somehow not like, because we were masked all the other times we're together. I don't know. It was strange. It was a strange experience. I don't know that I want to do it on a regular basis, but, Anyway, hopefully not one to get sick. So, and then the other thing I did this week was on Saturday, we had our Cub Scout Fishing Derby, and that was delayed and socially distanced. We're all spread out at our local Lake Holbrook here, and the four of the kids came with me. So the only two cubs we have now are Lucy and Anthony, but Ben and Bella came. Bella was because she's working on a fishing merit badge, and Ben just because he wanted to come along.
Because he likes fishing.
He likes fishing. He's pretty good. I mean, he'll catch stuff.
Didn't he catch a fish?
He's the one who caught our lone fish in our family this time. Lucy was funny. After a while, she got upset and just sat down and was mad because she wasn't catching anything, like, after a half hour.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is last year she caught, like, three fish in a half hour. And she's like, wow, this is awesome. I'm good at fishing. Like, beginner's luck. Yeah.
That's hard to explain to a seven-year-old.
Yeah, don't expect this to happen every time. Yeah. So.
And while you guys were fishing, Sophia and I went to the farmer's market.
Mm.
And we went earlier than we've been going. And so it was kind of nice because there were no lines yet. And so it was like, we have the farmer's market to ourselves.
That's nice.
Skipping lines. And then we went and got some coffee and then came home.
So anything interesting at the market? I mean, was it all different this time?
There was a mushroom vendor, which is the first.
We've had
mushroom vendors in past years, but this was the first time we've had mushrooms this year. So I was very excited about that.
We are like hobbits. We love mushrooms in this family.
So I got some oyster mushrooms and some shiitakes.
Yeah. Did they have any other kind?
They had like two different kinds of oysters, and I think they had some hen of the woods.
Okay.
The hen of the woods didn't look all that good, though.
Okay.
It just didn't really appeal to me, so I was, I don't know.
It's kind of tricky. Like, I know what to do with a porcini. I know what to do with a morel. But some of these other ones, I'm like, what do you do? Like, what do you do with mushrooms to really make them, to make it worth I'm buying these expensive mushrooms as opposed to, like onions. Like, they're just sort of part of the flavor of the dish.
Right.
You really got to highlight them.
Yeah. I sautéed these with a little bit of garlic and some red onion. And some butter and wine, which I thought really like brought out the mushroomy flavors, but not overwhelming them.
That's the trick.
Yeah.
You can't overwhelm the mushrooms.
Let's see. What else did we do? Oh, then I like bought some tomatoes and then from the one vendor who doesn't take credit cards. And I realized I did not have enough cash, like after I'd already embarrassed myself by like actually touching her tomatoes and putting them in a bag, so that now my cooties were all over the tomatoes. And she was just like, just give me what you have and take them. So now I'm bound to like go buy a whole bunch of stuff from her next week.
Well, she's the older lady who looks kind of crotchety.
She does, but she's really sweet. And she's been there since the market like was founded.
35 years she's been at the market every year. Yeah. She was like the first market manager, I think. Yeah. So, yeah, she's nice.
I felt so bad. I was like, I can't believe I'm stiffing Mary for the tomatoes. Oh, I am like so embarrassed.
Well, especially since it's not like a market where we go every week. Everybody knows us.
I know.
Well, it works out that way. She knows us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm the flaky lady with too many kids who can't remember how much money she put in her pockets in the morning.
Who cares? Like, who carries cash? The only place I ever spend cash is at the farmer's market. I cannot tell you the last time I went to an ATM. I literally cannot. In fact, I'm not sure I remember off the top of my head what my PIN is for my debit card.
Like, oh, I use mine at the grocery store.
Yeah, I literally. Everything is either the card in the reader or a Apple Pay.
But doesn't your card in the reader use the same PIN as your debit, your ATM?
I don't use the PIN in the reader. Like when I put the card in, I don't use it. Well, because I don't use my debit card. I always use the Apple card.
Oh,
so there's no PIN for that. Oh. I always do Apple Pay.
Even when I use Apple Pay with my watch, it wants me my PIN number.
Because it's the watch with the debit card as opposed to the Apple card.
Oh.
So I use the Apple card and then just pay it with the debit card in the Apple Wallet app. That way we get the 3% back or the 2% back.
You mean you should put that on my Apple
Wallet? Well, I would, except you're not, like, you can't. Oh. It's, they're stupid like that. Every other credit card lets you have
multiple cards?
Yeah, well, husband and wife, you know, on it. Uh-huh. But this one doesn't yet. So
that's stupid.
And you can, you know, we'd never be able to get one for you because you don't have a job.
Yeah, that's kind of sucks.
It's dumb.
Okay, so yeah. That's why I know my PIN and you don't. I usually get cash for things like that, like when I go grocery shopping, like I just add, you know, like $20 to the thing and get the $20 back.
Yeah.
Cash back. Yeah, yeah. That's what I do.
That's like a good idea.
Oh, most of my cash these days goes to pay Isabella, so my bribe money for pushing the shopping cart.
That's where she's earning her money, because she's planning to buy something. A Lego set, I think?
I think a Lego set.
Yeah, she was telling me. So I went to CVS the other day, and I'm like standing in line, and the line was taking too long, because people at CVS want to use like all those coupons. There's like, uh-huh. You get behind that lady who's got like 15 coupons.
But they give you a million coupons, right. So you got to use them,
There's someone out there who wants to use every single one of them, right? And so it's taking forever. I'm like, hey, they have a self-checkout now. I'm going to go over there and self-checkout.
I bet it didn't work, right?
I went over and it didn't work. And it said, wait for help. So I had to wait until after that lady was done anyway for the loan cashier to come over and help me. It was very annoying.
Oops. So
that's just,
thanks, CVS.
That's just CVS these days. CVS is always annoying. Sorry, lovely people that work at CVS, but the company's technology is terrible.
It is.
It's terrible. That's a whole nother rant. So the other thing that happened this week is, or today is, as we record this on Sunday, is my mom and dad came to visit.
It was very nice to have them over.
So my sister Francesca brought my mom and dad by after Mass, and they visited for a bit. And then she took my dad up to my other sister's up in Peabody for the day, and my mom stayed here, and then I drove my mom home after dinner. But yeah, it was really nice. We talked about Francesca and my brother Bernie and my dad and Evie, my sister Evie, have all done 23andMe genealogy swaps, and they're all in there. And so she was talking about, I think Bernie has, well, regardless, they were talking about the results, mm-hmm. and the differences, and how there's a certain amount of Ashkenazi Jewish, which is...
Which you pretty much knew. Well,
in my dad's DNA.
In your dad's side.
So my dad is Sicilian, which frankly means that... I forget which movie it was. There was a movie where they basically said, yeah, Sicily is the crossroads of the world. Everybody eventually goes through Sicily.
Well, right, yeah. If you know history, like...
The French have ruled it. The Greeks have ruled it. The North Africans have ruled it. Everybody has at one time or another apparently ruled Sicily and left their DNA in the people, so to speak.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, it's in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's like the Eastern and the Western Mediterranean. Like, it's right there in the middle.
It is literally the crossroads of the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
So we were talking about there was some Anatolian, like Northwestern Asian, Northwest Asian, which is like Turkey or Iran or that area. So, which is interesting. Because I was speculating it was some like merchant from Constantinople who came through.
You never know.
And fell in love. Let's just say he fell in love and settled down with a nice Sicilian girl.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. And it makes me kind of like, do I want to do it? Like, will I learn anything new?
I got to say, I'm kind of curious.
Well, yours would be interesting because you're a mutt.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what would jump. I actually haven't asked if any of my extended family have done it, so I'd be curious to like ask on the family page. Mm,
yeah, I mean, the whole Jimmy Aiken and I did the episode on the Golden State Killer. That's how he got caught.
Right.
It was not because he did it, because a relative did it, and because the mitochondrial DNA that you inherit from your mother can lead you to other relatives. Like it's
right.
I forget exactly how it works, but it would.
There's some very, very close match, and it can tell you how, like what degree of closeness or some.
And it can connect you with cousins, which is what this did is the 23andMe is like had listed all these people who are potential cousins, and you get to like say, oh yeah, they're cousin. And that's really, so it's mm-hmm. kind of neat, which led us to me talking about Ancestry.com, which is where I, years ago, entered in a whole bunch of genealogical stuff on my family. Your uncle has done your family.
We should at some point like merge the two so that our kids will have a merged
family tree. I think they're connected.
Are they?
On the Ancestry.
Oh. Yeah. I suppose I don't have an account. I should do that so I can look at
it. It's wicked expensive. Ancestry.com. Like, you can set up a free account where you can just look at things and search things and enter in, like, hand enter, manually enter stuff. But to use any of their resources, like they have all kinds of like records from around the world, birth records, military records, port of entry records, all kinds of stuff. But it's expensive to get it. It starts at $20 a month and goes up to 50.
But could you like sign up, research for a couple of months and then drop
it? I've done that. Yeah. You can get a 6 month for like $140, which it might be worth to do it again at some point to kind of update the records.
Right. Especially if, like, one of the kids had, like, a family history thing for scouts or something like that.
There's a I cannot say that word.
Genealogy
merit badge.
Yeah.
So that would be good.
Actually, it was kind of interesting that coincided because on a whim, I had bought a family tree book on Amazon. It was on one of the kids' curricula. And I just, like, handed it to Lucy because she happened to be the kid who was sitting there when I opened it. And it came today. And so Lucy was, when your parents arrived, she was filling out the personal information in this family tree book. Like, she was writing, she opened it up and she's like, name. And so she writes her name. And I'm like, okay, I guess we're doing this. And so I helped her fill out name, address. It had like three lines for hobbies. And she was like, who has that many hobbies? Says the 7-year-old.
Who has that many hobbies?
She puts Cub Scouts, and that was about the only thing she could think of as a hobby. So that's what it was, like hobbies and sports.
Uh huh.
She doesn't do any sports.
Right.
Yeah.
That is funny.
It was really funny.
I get scouts who wouldn't be able to fit them all in three lines, the number of sports.
Exactly.
That's funny. So it was interesting. And then we got to talking about tracing a family tree, and like we could trace my dad's great grandfather. So my great great grandfather back to the 1700s. He was born in the 1700s. My great great grandfather, which is kind of crazy when you think about it, because my grandfather was born in the 1800s.
Right.
And, you know, so, I mean, that's just crazy to think about that span of time and that few generations.
That is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, my family tree, I think my uncle has traced back at least one branch back to like
Charlemagne.
No, but like the Isle of Wight in the 1600s.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
On my mom's, the French side, we go back to the 1600s. Is one the furthest one back is in the 1600s. So, I mean, it's fascinating. I love that sort of stuff. And there's so many interesting stories. I was telling my mom, reminding her that one of her ancestors, Simon Pierre LeBlanc from Nova Scotia, and his brothers, just five of them, all were merchantmen who owned a ship called the Enterprise. Like, it was destiny that I would be a Star Trek fan. The Enterprise. So it was kind of cool. And so there's all kinds of interesting stories.
Or since their name was LeBlanc, it was probably L'Enterprise.
Enterprise. Yes, that's probably what it was. There was the priest who was in Montreal during the war with the British, who was imprisoned by the British. There's a couple of interesting stories in the family tree. So that was fun. And then, my mom stayed, and then I drove her home afterward. And it was good. It's always good to have, you know, the kids be around my parents. They don't get to see your parents as often, obviously, because they're so far away. Although there was a time when they saw your parents more than they saw my dad. But now that my dad is living in the next town over, or, you know, two towns over, it's a lot easier. And it is good that they get to see them, because I never really knew my grandparents. So
my grandparents all lived out of state, except for the like 1 year that my mom's mom got an apartment in Austin.
Really?
It was like for a year. And I think she just decided that she didn't really like it. And she moved back to Arizona. I was young. I was like, I think like 12 at that time, and I didn't really understand like both either why she moved to Austin or why she moved away afterward. It was just like, oh, grandma's here, and she got an apartment that was right behind my elementary school.
Oh wow!
And so the arrangement was that, well, obviously then I would walk over to grandma's apartment after school was over, And I didn't always want to go hang out with my grandma after school was over, but I really didn't have much choice. It was like, well, this is what you're doing. I think eventually I negotiated down to like 2 days a week or something, because I really couldn't get much homework done because my grandma always wanted to talk.
Yes. My mom's Uncle Albert. So he was, my mom's dad died when she was seven. And so her uncle, who was bachelor uncle, took in my grandmother and my mom and took care of them. And so he was kind of like a grandfather in that sense. But he ended up living in our town near at the end of his life in an apartment. And I remember having to go over to his house. Like my mom, the expectation, like, you need to go over and visit him now that he's living in town. It's like, why? Like, what are we going to talk about? What am I going to do there? Yeah. Well, you got to get to know Uncle Albert. Okay. I guess spend time with him. Okay. You know, like what are you, like you're 10, 12, what, you know, 13, what, you know, so it was this man who I didn't really hadn't spent time with otherwise. It's very strange.
It's a very weird negotiation. Like, now seeing it from the adult perspective, but for children, like the expectations that adults have of you that you don't right. have the life experience to understand why.
Yeah. Yeah. And for us, it's like, we want you to get to know this person who is important in our lives.
Right.
And
who may not be around for much longer.
Right. But you don't want to say it because it's morbid and you don't want to freak out the kid. But yet the expectation that's you're kind of trying to leave the implication there, like you need to do this or you'll regret it later because you'll be grown up saying I never knew my grandparents.
Right.
Yeah. So it's tricky. It's tricky. I'm glad our kids, they know and love their grandparents and they are able to talk to them, whether in person or in FaceTime or what have you. So that's good.
It is.
I wish they could spend more time with them, but you know, the world is what it is right now.
Times being what they are.
So let's talk about what you there was something you said you were we were doing some special learning with this week. We have a house guest, but a safe one who is not going to give us COVID.
Not really a house guest.
Well, a living outside the house on our patio guest.
In short, we have a spider.
We have a spider. We've named her Charlotte.
Somebody has named her Charlotte.
I've named her Charlotte.
Tom has called her
what
Charlotte.
Else are you going to name a spider? I mean, you're not going to call it Shelob. That's rude.
So we have an orb weaver spider who's been living on our patio for a couple weeks now. She seems to build a web, like, not exactly every day, maybe like every 2 days. And then it like lasts for about a day and then it gets beat up and then she eats it and then she builds a new one.
Beat up by the wind and the leaves flying around. She builds it. It's interesting. She's been building it partly anchored on our wind chimes.
Some of them have been anchored on the wind chimes.
I think she's learned her lesson.
Yeah, she's moved away from the wind chimes now, but for several different web iterations were. Anyway, we've been learning about spiders. I've made an opportunity to make it into a sort of science project.
Everything's a homeschool lesson.
Exactly. One afternoon, the boys and Lucy and I actually stood on the patio and watched the spiders spin the web that had been destroyed, like make the web. And it was really cool. Like you could get up really close, like a couple inches away from the spider while she's spinning. And
all the arachnophobes out there are going, what are you doing? That just sounds horrific to me.
It was really cool. And so then
she is kind of big.
Her body is like about the size of, I don't know, a quarter. Maybe?
A quarter.
Yeah.
The body is the size of a quarter. The body. Then there are the legs. She's pregnant. She's obviously getting ready to, not pregnant, but you know what I mean. The spider equivalent. She's preparing to breed.
No, she's got an egg sac in her abdomen.
There you go. That's the correct terminology.
Yes. Anyway. That led me on to like some internet searches for spiders and learning about different kinds of spider webs. Ours is an orb weaver. And so hers is an orb web, but there are different other kinds of webs. We also identified a blanket web in another corner of the patio covering.
Gazebo, we call it. It's not a gazebo.
It's not a gazebo.
That's what we call it because we don't know what else to call it.
And then and we've seen some in the hosta plants. We have some like the ones that do the like funnel traps. Those are cool.
Those are cool.
And I learned that cobweb is actually a kind of web.
a specific kind of spider web.
Right.
It's not just any kind of spider web. It's a specific
kind. Specific kind. Anyway, so then this led me into a really weird rabbit trail, which was learning about golden spider silk and a shawl and a cape that were made out of golden spider silk. These spiders are orb weavers, kind of like our little friend Charlotte.
Yes.
But they live in Madagascar, and the silk that they spin is gold. And a couple of guys in Madagascar figured out how to harvest spider silk. I think it was some like...
Were they lemurs?
3 million. I think it was something like 3 million spiders that they harvested silk from.
Do they keep 3 million spiders?
No, they would. No, they actually released. They would take some silk and then they would release them back into the wild.
Oh, okay.
It was a humane, cruelty free. Yes.
Except for the guy they hired to go harvest the spiders.
No, actually, they were paying local people would collect them and come and bring them. Like, were being paid per spider. They had some like cute images in the video of like kids who would like just show up with like one spider in their hands. Yeah. They don't bite.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was really cool. Like they ended up weaving this shawl and this cape out of spider silk. And the color of this silk, the natural color, is this gorgeous, gorgeous golden color. And, the shawl they wove with traditional Madagascar
techniques.
Like the embroidery itself has patterns woven into it. And the cape was just a plain, like solid fabric. But then they embroidered on it. And the embroidery pattern has spiders in it, like spiders and vines and flowers and such. Now, evidently, spider silk is very delicate, like fragile, and it's very susceptible to
tearing.
Not tearing, it's very strong, but to water and heat.
Oh.
So like it doesn't like it doesn't like getting wet or extremes of temperature, but it's very strong.
Hmm.
And they have like only have had two models wear the cape. So there's if you look online for golden spider silk,
I'll try to put the link in the show notes.
And you can Anyway, it's pretty fabulous. Even if you are freaked out by spiders, the textiles themselves are really gorgeous.
Wow.
So the kids and I spent an entire morning of goofing off of the rest of school, binge watching a whole bunch of different videos on YouTube. There was one from the Victoria and Albert Museum. There was one from the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And then a friend of mine said that she'd actually taken her son to the Royal Ontario Museum and they'd seen the cape when it was there a couple years ago. And I think there was a video from somewhere else. Oh, the Art Institute of Chicago. So we did three different videos from three different museums where these have visited.
Wow.
They're permanently in residence in Madagascar, but they occasionally travel out of the country.
Of course. Yeah. Oh, interesting. That's a interesting. Well, I mean, that is such a very Halloween appropriate lesson. Right.
Anyway, these are like the only textiles that have actually been woven from spider silk, other than some that were woven in like 1900 or 1910, but that have subsequently been lost.
Mm.
And the technique was evidently lost too. Although I kind of got the feeling that maybe some of the local people in Madagascar were already doing this textile and this was just sort of like a bigger scale production or something.
Right.
I feel like something was getting lost in translation there.
Interesting. Very good. Spiders. It is safe to come back to the podcast, folks, for those of you who are arachnophobic. We're done talking about spiders. I mean, it's surprising. I'm actually a little arachnophobic, but not in the, like, eek a spider and run away, but more like I don't like spiders being in my space. Like, outside, that's fine. In the attic, I have no problem with it. If you come into where I can reach, you're dead. I watched the movie Arachnophobia when I was younger.
I see.
And that was
a bad explains
idea.
A lot.
Yes.
I don't mind spiders so much when they're like up in the corners far away from me. When they start like dangling on a thread near my head, that yeah. I don't want them in my hair. Well,
that and the big spiders, like daddy long legs. I could let a daddy long leg run on my arm. That doesn't bother me in the least. But like big hairy,
like the wolf spiders,
segmented wolf spiders, segmented spiders. No, thank you.
I thought we were done with spiders.
Huh?
You said we were done.
We're done with spiders. It's safe to come back to the podcast now.
You're lying.
Oops.
Nobody is going to believe you ever again.
Moving on. Let's talk about what we ate.
Okay. Much safer.
That's much safer. So this week I made a recipe from Cooks Illustrated, that from a recent issue, or Cooks Country magazine. Same thing. They recently offered, called Sticky Chicken, or as I like, we kept calling it, Stinky Chicken.
It was not stinky.
Cider vinegar is a large component of the glaze, so it has a vinegary smell, but it wasn't like gross. It just was strongly smell. What did you think of it?
It was okay.
Some of the kids liked it. So here's how it goes. It's really easy. It's chicken thighs. Okay. And then you make a simple braising liquid: cider vinegar, honey, soy sauce, ketchup, granulated garlic, red pepper flakes. All right. You pour that, you put it in a skillet with the skin side down in the oven, which is interesting. So it starts in the oven in a skillet. Then you, after a while, you flip it back up and then you cook it, continue to cook it in the oven as the skin gets browned. Like, it gets pretty dark. In fact, it's partly because of the honey. It's the glaze is really caramelizing the skin. Then you, once the chicken reaches temperature, you take it out. And then you defat the liquid, the remaining liquid. You take the fat out of it through a fat separator and put it back in and reduce it and then thicken it a little bit. Their recipe has cornstarch, so I had to use arrowroot. And it makes it a nice thick sauce that you pour over it, and you add some sesame seeds on it, and it's pretty good. The one thing we both agreed, though, was it would be better if the skin were crispy.
Here's the thing. Any chicken thigh recipe that we try out is going to have to stand up against the standard favorite chicken thigh, which is my lazy recipe that I do on weeknights when I don't feel like cooking.
Right.
Which is basically, I just take the chicken thighs, I put a mixture of herbs and spices on it, basically like onion powder, garlic powder, pepper, salt, some like herbs. And then I just throw it in the oven at like 425 for 45 minutes to an hour until the skin gets like really crispy. But it's like crispy with lots of like herb flavor and the garlic flavor. And I really like it. And the kids really like it. And so like any recipe that we try has to like be better than that in order to really
be a winner. Win them over. What if we did this, but we took the skin at the end of it and put it on a baking sheet in the oven to crisp up.
I don't know. I mean, it's okay. I'm just not a huge, I'm not as much of a fan of like the sweet as I am. Like, okay. I like sweet sauces if it's like a sweet and sour chicken that has like the vegetables and the pineapple and the peppers and the broccoli and stuff.
Well, this wasn't super sweet.
I don't know.
It was sweet and sour. It was honey and vinegar.
Right. If it was missing something, I don't
see
know.
The thing that I like the weeknight, the chicken that you make, but it needs a sauce. Like, I feel like that's
where we disagree, because yeah. I do not feel like it's at all lacking in a sauce.
Well, because so what do we eat it with? We usually eat it with rice and like a vegetable on the side. And it feels kind of plain to me, which is why I'm always pouring sriracha all over my rice to give it. Because when I was a kid, I didn't like rice because it was too plain. And then I'd pour soy sauce all over it, which made it way too salty and barely edible. But I feel like rice needs something. And I like having the chicken and the rice and a sauce. I don't know, just me, but I'll have to figure something else out. But I think there's something in the, if you can take the skin and cook it separately, the meat will absorb more of the braising liquid. Anyway, but apparently we're not going to be making this again. So the the other dish I made with that dinner was a stovetop cauliflower with garlic and thyme. Since the chicken was in the oven, we couldn't just do our normal roasted cauliflower. So I found a recipe that does cauliflower on the stovetop. So you basically just cut up the head of cauliflower into like 1-inch bits, and then with olive oil in the pan and salt and pepper, and you just cook the cauliflower in the pan until it's brown. And then you add in a mixture of oil, garlic, and thyme, and mix that together. And it tasted okay, but it was way too oily.
It was really oily, and it wasn't brown enough. It wasn't like, no. It didn't have the nice, I mean, I really like the oven cooked because it gets kind of crunchy.
Well, and this claims to make it browned. The picture from the magazine, it's really browned. Like, there are brown spots.
I think that our stovetop, I think that they tend to cook on gas.
Cook on gas. We have electric, and I think that makes
our stovetop does not get that hot.
Well, it doesn't get the right kind of heat. I think because electrics turn on and off, they're not a steady high heat, and I think that's a big difference. I also think there was way too much oil in the recipe.
Way too much oil.
Heat a quarter cup of oil in the skillet. That's a way more oil than it needed. I don't understand that.
Honestly, the oil level reminded me of vegetables that I had when I was in Greece.
Literally.
I mean, literally, it felt like most of the restaurants we ate at or the hotels we ate at, the food was really, really, really covered in olive oil.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't dislike olive oil, but... yeah, it was a little bit much sometimes.
Yeah. So that meal was okay. But I mean, I like the flavors in the sticky chicken, but it was all right. It was all right. We'll probably end up making our regular.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to try something new. So I've got to make something new for the podcast every week, you know,
right.
I have something to talk about. So then tonight you were ambitious for tonight's dinner.
I made lasagna.
Okay. Lasagna. The big debate. Now I have to recognize that you made lasagna the way I prefer it. And I really do appreciate it. Wait a minute. I didn't set out to make to concede to you the way lasagna should be made.
I made lasagna the way I liked.
Well, the question we have debated in the past is, does lasagna have vegetables or not?
But of course it has vegetables. It's got tomatoes and
fruit. Does lasagna have spinach and mushrooms and other plant-like things? Or is lasagna pasta, cheese, sauce, and maybe meat? Which, the meat in this one, you made a meat lasagna, it was really good. And I'm a purist. Lasagna does not have vegetables, apart from the sauce. And maybe some parsley.
There was a lot of parsley in this.
Yes, which is
there fine. Was like half a cup of parsley in this. Sophie looked at me and she was like, "That's a lot of parsley."
No. The parsley was fine.
Yeah. My mom used to make it with either peas or frozen spinach in the cheese mixture. And I really like it with the frozen spinach. And then I got big leaves of spinach, like finely chopped so that it's like the texture is not different than parsley.
If it was like the parsley, but at which point I'm saying, then why are you like bothering because you can't even taste it?
Because you're getting vegetable into children who are picky and don't want to eat vegetables.
I might be projecting from like the thick mushroom zucchini and other things, pastas, like lasagnas I've seen.
Right.
With runny sauces.
You've never actually let me try to make the lasagna that I've never tried it.
The one you made tonight was so good, you don't have to make any other kind. Uh-huh. It went fast, by the way.
There was like two pieces left.
Like the kids ate, like, we're going to have to start, we're getting to the point where you're going to have to start making much bigger pans of food.
I don't know how to make more than a 13 by 9 of lasagna.
12 by 9.
12 by 9. 13.
Whatever. Anyway, big roasting pan. I mean, when my sister Francesca used to make lasagna for our family, she would get the big roasting pan out Like, how many boxes of lasagna did you use?
One.
Yeah, she would use two boxes.
Two boxes.
Yeah.
That's a lot of lasagna. It's I'd have to make twice as much sauce, too.
Twice as much sauce.
And get the big thing of ricotta.
Yes, the big thing of ricotta. Yes, that's what she would use, is the big thing of ricotta.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
I'm not quite there yet.
If you want to have leftover lasagna, you're going to need to make a lot of lasagna. That's
I guess so. But we don't have much room in the refrigerator for that much lasagna.
It freezes. It freezes well.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you
about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I basically, somebody asked me where I got the recipe for the lasagna. Was it, I don't know if it was your mom or one of the kids.
Did, yeah.
And literally, I have never seen a recipe written for lasagna. I learned how to make lasagna by watching and helping my mom make it. And I mean, I just like make lasagna. I make my basic sauce,
yep,
which has changed a lot over time. So my sauce now is not really much like my sauce used to be.
Yes. I think we've created a new
perfected sauce.
Yes, it is really perfect. All perfect.
And so my Italian, so my lasagna sauce is basically my just basic sauce, but I added some ground beef, mm-hmm, to it. Which I think lasagna, I do not like lasagna with no meat.
I think I'm up on meat lasagna. Ground beef, I can deal maybe sometimes with like a pepperoni or salami.
Right. That's the one thing I did not do this time because we didn't really have a whole lot of salami. But my mom always chopped up salami into fine bits and put it in with the cheese mixture.
Yeah. But that can sometimes cause it to be a little too acidic and a little heartburny.
Yeah, it can be a little bit greasy.
Yeah,
I suppose. But I like the salami flavor.
Yeah.
But I think the sauce that I've perfected now kind of compensates for that because it has some of those flavors.
Yes.
In it with like the fennel and the anise.
Yep.
So I don't feel like it's lacking as much.
Yes. And which fennel and anise are in most Italian salumis, or many of them anyway. So that's a common
it's
flavor.
It's a flavor.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really good. I think my mom loved it. I think she really enjoyed it. So that's high praise. I thought my dad might be staying for dinner. I didn't realize he wasn't staying for dinner too.
It would have been nice if he'd stayed, although we would have run out of lasagna.
Yes. Well, my dad doesn't eat very much.
That's
these
true.
Days.
He eats like a bird.
He does. But
a little old man.
Yeah. But it would have been interesting to get his take. Obviously my dad would have been complimentary.
I've never heard your dad be anything but over the top complimentary about anything. So
right. But I still would like to share with him. I think he's been impressed with the cooking that we've shared with him over time. So it's been good. So that's what we've been cooking. One of these days we'll have to put that recipe for the sauce online. You're going to have to write it down.
I will.
And really codify it.
It's kind of hard to write down though, because I cook like an Italian grandma.
Yeah, you do. We'll make a video.
Oh, that's an idea.
That would be fun. We could do that. That's coming. All right. So moving on to what we're reading and watching. So I watched the Ted Lasso season finale.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really good. I think I talked about it last time.
You did.
The episode before it. I really like it. It was such a great series. Like, there's a couple things I don't like about it. It uses a lot of bad language. Partly because it's set in Britain and they love their bad language around soccer. And there's more sexual innuendo than I think would be great. I mean, if it didn't have all that, it would be a great show to for the family even, because there's so, like, apart from the sexual innuendo, because there's so many elements of forgiveness, of caring for one another, of being a family. You know, wow. I mean, so non-cynical. It's a really great show. I'm so glad. Between that and For All Mankind, those would be enough reason for me to want to watch Apple TV Plus, which once they come out with the new Apple bundle, they have an Apple services bundle. We use enough of the services that it's actually a better deal for us to get the bundle. So we're going to have it anyway, but that mm-hmm. in Apple Fitness something Fitness Plus, whatever they call it. So
like a fitness thing that works with your watch.
Yes, with videos and stuff. and it will project on the Apple TV. It will project what your watch's readings of your heart rate and stuff on the TV as you're working out to, you know, Jane and the Leotard or, you know, whatever.
Uh-huh.
Fitness videos. Yeah.
I'm not a fitness video person.
I don't expect that we'll be using that part of the service very much. So watch that. Then on Amazon, I don't know what it is about Amazon, but they've really gone for the let's show gory stuff demo. Like, they're really into splatter fest sort of stuff. So I watched this first episode of this new series called Utopia. And it's, I think it's based on a graphic novel, but it's about a graphic novel. So in this world, there, like the, in the story, there was this novel, this graphic novel that came out like in 2014 called Dystopia. And it was really, you know, freaked out and told the story of a scientist and his daughter who were kidnapped and made to do work for these guys and blah, 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 and they escape. And then it was a cult hit graphic novel. No one really knew where it came from. It needed a sequel because it left on a cliffhanger. And then someone suddenly discovers where the series picks up. Someone discovers the manuscript, like the manuscript, you know, the drawings and everything for the sequel called Utopia. And everybody wants it for different reasons. And there's this group of online friends who want to get it because, not because they're comic book fans, but because they believe that the original graphic novel had all kinds of secrets, clues to, it predicted all kinds of bad things that happened in the world in the past 5 years, various pandemics and wars and natural disasters. And somehow the novel was predicting it, but it was all this arcane sort of, see, when you look at these three things in this panel, and when they line up and they indicate this and they form the symbol for this, you know, that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
So you think they're kind of wacky, you know, and it's these really interesting, set was sort of interesting, very different personalities who'd never met in person. And finally they get together to meet to get the book. But it turns out, and without spoiling anything, it turns out there is something going on because someone's willing to kill for it. So now that sounds interesting, but there was so much gratuitous violence in the first episode. I just can't stomach it. I just like, I'm not that interested in it to keep watching, you know. It was mm-hmm. like The Boys. It was so splatterfest. It just became like, there's an interesting premise in here, but I can't get to it through all the gore. You know what I mean? It was just way over the top. And I don't know if Amazon has decided that that's the demo, that's how they're going to go, or those are just the shows I'm running into. I mean, they've had previous Amazon originals that I've liked, like Man in the High Castle, that didn't do all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. And there's the other one with the girl, the Hannah.
Right.
Which wasn't all gore fest. It was violent, like, you know, super, you know, secret agent violent, but not gore fest. Anyway, so not a recommendation. I can't recommend that one.
Yeah, I have not been watching anything other than YouTube videos. Really. I
want to get her to watch the Netflix Hubie's Halloween with me, no, with Adam Sandler.
I am not an Adam Sandler fan.
Apart from the one 50 First Dates.
Right. That's the exception that proves the rule. And really, there were a lot of parts of that movie that I didn't like because it was very Adam Sandler-y.
Well, the reason I would want to watch Hubie's Halloween is because it's set in Salem, where we met and married and had our first child.
That the only thing that I would that would induce me to watch that movie is the fact that it's Salem.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Halloween is a kind of big thing in Salem. And although it was a big thing in Salem that I mostly raged about at the time when we lived there.
Having to live in Salem during Halloween. Yeah.
Like the month of October was just a nightmare.
Yeah.
So much traffic, so many people, so much everything.
Yeah.
Yuck. Yeah. So this week, basically, my reading has been, I reread Deadly Education by Naomi Novik. Because I loved it so much that I felt like I wanted to reread it again.
And be able to talk about it in your new
I started a Facebook group to talk about it. So because I feel really bad about talking about a brand new release book
in public.
I don't want to spoil people. So I frequently, if I want to talk about a book that's recently released with friends who've also read it, I'll start a private group. And then I'll say, if you finish the book or you don't mind spoilers, come and join my group.
I think this is literally the first time you've ever added me to one of these groups.
Well, it's the first time you've ever actually read the book. It's
the first time we both read the book that we're interested in.
Right.
Even though I introduced you to Naomi Novik.
This is true. You did. Anyway, so I've had some fun with the group. I mean, I was having private conversations like one-on-one in Facebook Messenger with a couple of friends. And I'm like, you know, you should be talking to you and me all together in one place. And I could do that like by adding everyone to a Messenger group. But then I also find Messenger frustrating because in order to go find back an earlier part of the conversation, you have to scroll. Whereas a group.
Right. You just look at the different posts.
You just can go to the posts. It's easier to navigate and find like parts of the conversation.
Yeah, Messenger doesn't have good threading.
It really, yeah, it sucks for that.
So, and then you started a whole bunch of books, but you're not ready to talk about them.
And I read one juvenile novel that I didn't like, and I don't really feel like spending a lot of time being negative about it, so I'm just going to skip that part.
And I finished another Dresden Files book. So I'm sorry, folks. I'm going to catch up to the currently published Dresden Files books and start moving on to other books, but at the moment, I'm still working my way through it. It was Changes, literally a perfect title for that because everything changes in that book. It's interesting. You were telling me that some of our friends who were reading the series, that was the book that stopped them on the series. They'd like, I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah.
On that. So it's kind of interesting. I'm reading the next one called Ghost Story now, and I'm having a hard time making my way through it because I'm halfway through. And it's a bit of a slog.
It's kind of slow.
Yeah.
It's a slow starter, especially after the pace of Changes. Like I really think that he sort of did that deliberately because he's interested in these kinds of things.
Yeah, the author, Butcher.
The author. I've listened to a really interesting interview about like his most recent books.
Right. And which I can't watch because I haven't read them.
Right. But he talked a little bit about his inspiration for that. He said he really wanted it to kind of be like Quentin Tarantino's Dusk Till Dawn film, which
I might have seen that, but I don't remember.
Dusk Till Dawn is a
vampire movie.
Well, it's really, really weird because the first half of the movie is not a vampire movie. It's like two movies that were stuck together in the middle. And like the second half is like vampire slasher gore film. And the first half is not.
That sounds like Tarantino.
It was very Tarantino. Anyway, evidently Jim Butcher kind of wanted his latest novel to be that, but then it got too big, and so the two halves actually got split up into two different novels.
In the current, you mean the two newest novels?
The two newest novels.
Right.
But I kind of feel like that with Changes and Ghost Story, there's a similar dynamic of the like action.
Changes is frenetic.
It is like the pace is just nonstop.
Right. Whereas Ghost Story is like, stop.
Ghost Story is like, okay, everything comes to a halt. No, stop. We're going to think about things for a little bit now.
Yeah.
We're going to process what just happened.
That's a little hard to take. Yeah,
it is. I mean, it's risky.
And it's also very different from all the other books.
It is.
And when you're on the 13th, I think, book in a series and to suddenly change everything, that's a very risky move.
But then again, when you're on the 13th book, if you've got people who've stuck through with you, there's a good chance that a lot of them will continue.
Okay, right, which is why the publisher went along with it and didn't say, no way. But also,
I think that by book 13, unless you change something up, even the most successful formula tends to get formulaic and stale.
It's like a TV series after four seasons. You could look at a TV series that's been on for a long time. After about season three or four, they switch things up. They change things.
You have to change things.
It's the 7 of 9 moment.
Or the opening the hatch and Lost.
Opening the hatch and Lost. Well, that was season three or two.
Oh,
I think that was season two.
No. Wait. When is the moment when they like suddenly like shift gears? No,
they shift the gears to off the island.
Off the island.
Like,
that's
now
right.
They're no longer doing flashbacks. They're doing flash forwards or whatever it is.
Yeah,
sideways.
Whatever
Yeah.
Anyway,
while we were watching, we didn't know what it was. But yeah, that's right. You have to switch things up. And then you look at things like Law and Order or CSI, not CSI, NCIS, that have been on that are on for 15 years, and like they've been doing the same thing over and over, and you're like, I got bored with NCIS like about 6 years ago.
Yeah, I stopped watching
it. Yeah, I mean, I love the characters.
Right, but
it was just the same thing over and over and over again.
Right. How many dead bodies can they possibly find? How many mysteries can there be?
CSI was the same thing. Like, they tried to mix it up, but after a while, and then they had CSI Miami and CSI New York, and I forget, they might have had others. And I was like, I just stopped watching all the other ones, and then I finally stopped watching the original.
But see, I think that the secret is, for a good procedural or detective series, there has to be some personal interest. Like, you have to, at some point, you kind of start reading for the character stories.
Right. It's not about the case.
It's about the character arcs.
Well, in fact, with the Dresden Files, again, I'm on book 12 or 13 or whatever it is. There hasn't been a case, like a literal private detective case in about six books.
Right.
Like, he left the whole, you know, what's the film noir detective.
Right.
You know, he's left the whole private detective thing way behind.
Well, evidently the first like three or four novels, whatever it was, were written for a creative writing class.
Right.
And then like, I think once he got an agent and like a contract, he kind of felt free to then.
He just wanted to do professional wizard in the modern world.
Right. He kind of ditched the formula.
Right. Well, cause he, well, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who's read it, but he found another way of supporting himself without having to be a private detective, and that freed up the character to do all kinds of other things. Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it after we're done, because I don't want to spoil anybody. Right.
Anyway, series, I think long-running series, there's always a trick. Like, how do you make them continue to be interesting over a long period of time? How do you tell story after story after story about the same characters without
sometimes they
getting
skip,
boring?
They skip time. Like, they're like the Battlestar Galactica, the reboot series, after like season two, they skipped like 3 years in time. Like, there's all these events that you come back to the season three premiere and you're like, what was that? Like, or the Expanse book series does that somewhere around the last three books in the series.
Mm-hmm.
You have this huge jump in time because you gotta, like, it's like the author realizes I'm in a rut.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Sterling did that in the Change series.
Yeah, I didn't like it after that point. I gave up. I stopped reading.
Several times, the jump in time.
I stopped reading after the first jump.
Well, so the first three books.
Yeah.
Then there's the second three books.
I read the first three, then I read the second three, and then I think I read like the first one of the next, and then I was like, no, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm out.
Yeah. I was at that point reading out of obligation. As it was in for a penny, in for a pound, I want to get to the end. And I did. I got to the end of the series.
And was it worth it?
No. Well, sort of.
See, you did not make me feel like any desire to finish the series.
No, you don't
need
to feel any. There's no need for you to finish the series. There was a couple. There was like one book that took place the entire book was one battle.
No, yeah, no. That's not necessary.
By the end of that book, I was a little upset.
Ironically, actually, that's the latest Dresden Files book. The entire book, Battleground, is literally one battle. But it worked.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well. Yeah, Sterling's one battle thing was he has this thing where he likes to jump around in time.
Uh-huh.
You know, one character's viewpoint is three weeks ago, the next character's viewpoint is, you know, 2 weeks in the future. And it's like, it gets confusing.
No. If you're going to do one battle, you can't do time jumps and one battle. You have to do all in one battle. That's it. You start at the beginning and you go through to the end.
Sterling has this thing where he likes to jump character viewpoints and do it in over different time periods. And it's like Christopher Nolan's movie about Dunkirk, where it was like each viewpoint was of a different time period. Yeah. It's famously this cinematic gimmick that he did, storytelling gimmick. And it's like, but that was easier. But with books, it's like, wait, when was this? I was constantly like scrolling back to the last time this character showed, like, who is this? Where were they? And when was it?
I hate it when a novel does not make sense unless you pay really close attention to the date at the beginning of each chapter. Like, that drives me crazy because I am not the kind of reader who pays very close attention to that kind of detail. Dates do not register in my consciousness. Like, I have a hardest time remembering dates.
Yeah, whereas Sterling is clearly the type of author who loves the details, loves the unimportant details.
I am not that kind of reader. I am not a good reader of that kind of book.
It's frustrating. When Sterling writes a single book, like he's got several single novels, those are really good because they're self-contained and they tell the whole story. But he was given sort of free rein here and it just went shoo.
Like, some authors really need a leash.
They do.
or a vicious, ruthless editor.
Yes. They do. Yeah. I can think of Tom Clancy was that way. When certain authors get so big, they get beyond editors.
Like
they
Stephen
get out
King.
Of control. And their books, you can tell because their books start to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
J.K. Rowling.
Yes. I mean, seriously, you just go to like any of these old authors who are like Stephen King or whatever. As they got more popular, their books got bigger and bigger.
And a lot of times they just needed to be cut.
Right. They don't need all that. Like, I remember. Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to get the whole other tangent.
Speaking of books that need to be cut, my favorite.
Speaking of podcasts that need to be. Yeah. Go ahead.
I just want to say my favorite assignment in high school was I had a teacher who assigned Charles Dickens' Bleak House, which is like an 800 page tome. And her assignment was we had to cut it by a third.
Oh, wow.
But that's a test of whether or not you've actually read the book, because like unless you've read the thing, you don't know what
needs to be cut.
What can be cut?
Yeah,
I was the only. It was also a group.
That's devious.
It was a group project, and guess who was the only person in her group who had actually read the whole book?
And guess who ended up doing all the work?
I did all the work. Yes, thank you very much.
You're that girl.
I was all the work. I was that one. Yeah. Yeah.
And the others were smart enough to ride your coattails.
Mm-hmm. I loved that book, though.
All right.
Sorry. Okay.
Last topic, because this podcast needs an editor. We're going to talk about today's mass readings. So this is the 28th Sunday in Ordinary Time. Have you been tangent a little bit? Facebook live stream from our parish.
Yes.
For several weeks running, the caption at the bottom of the title of the video is the 27th Sanday, S-A-N-D-A-Y, in Ordinary Time.
Yeah.
The 28th Sanday. Like, someone is clearly not paying attention when they change that.
They're not changing the word
Sunday.
Sanday.
Yes. It's I just thought that was funny.
The guy who does the videos for the parish is Cape Verdean.
Right, so
English is not his first language.
Yeah, and he does a great job. He does. There are things I would do a little differently, but he's apparently a volunteer. He's got a lot of technology and equipment, and he makes it unobtrusive and gives us the ability to watch the mass in a fairly well produced manner.
Yeah, it does make us giggle a little bit. The kids like to point it out.
Yes. All right, so today's readings were all about feasting.
Yes.
Feasting, and then in the second reading, a little bit about famine, like not feasting. So the first reading was from Isaiah, and there was this great image. On the mountain, the Lord of hosts, on this mountain, and we have to step back and wonder which mountain we're talking about. It's Jerusalem, the New Jerusalem. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will provide for all peoples a feast of rich foods and choice wines.
Juicy, rich food and pure choice wines. I love that. I don't know why. That just hits me right like there.
Right in the poetic heart.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is it's very evocative. That idea, like that imagery, like it's a feast of rich foods and choice wines. Juicy rich foods and pure choice wines. Like, he's selling it. like, come on, folks. This isn't just rich food. It's juicy. It's got all those juices. Talk about ASMR.
But you can feel it in your mouth. Like,
right. And like I was saying to Melanie earlier today, this is from a time when the food you ate was the food you produced. And when food ran out, you went without. You know, they didn't go to supermarkets and buy today's beef. You know, if you preserved it, you saved it. You might buy preserved food from someone else. I mean, there might be available in a, you know, that sort of thing. But like the ability to get juicy, rich foods and pure choice wines was not a given like
feasts,
today.
And feasts were such a big thing because they were so rare.
Right.
To have like a meal where you sit down and you just have an abundance, an overabundance of food that's just really the best food, that happens like once or twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's a communal thing where everyone's getting together and pooling their food so that they can have an abundant feast.
Right.
Like a harvest festival. Right?
Yes. Yes. Or weddings or wedding feast.
Which
is the gospel.
Yes.
So I do want to note that the psalm, even though you don't always get the psalm, they sometimes substitute, is Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." So
you spread the table before me in the sight of my foes. There you go. Another feast.
Right. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. More feasting. More
overflowing. Abundance. More abundance. Right. Yes.
So that brings us to the second reading, Philemon. And there's this lovely duality that Paul...
I love the rhythm of this reading. It's so...
Right.
Yeah.
So he says, I know how to live in humble circumstances. I know also how to live with abundance. Then just skipping ahead. I've learned the secret of being well-fed and of going hungry. Of living in abundance and of being in need. Like, there's this duality of I know how to do it with when I've got plenty and when I don't have any. You know, there's this
right
this imagery that he's putting there. And then he says, I can do all things in him who strengthens me.
You know, it's funny because I see that line, I can do all things in him who strengthens me, excerpted a lot, like no yes. context. It's a favorite quote for like posters and buttons
right,
and things.
Because it's rightly a nice so. Way of thinking God provides for me.
But it's jumped out at me in the context of the reading, like of this idea of feasting and abundance versus need and famine. And that I can go through both the experiences of having an abundance and being in want because of God.
Well, and there's also this need for God, even in abundance. Like God isn't, I don't just need God when I have nothing. I also need God to know how to do, to live in abundance.
Right. And then the final little bit is in accord with his glorious riches in Christ Jesus, reminding us that what we really need, the true abundance that we're craving is the abundance of the riches that Christ gives us.
And this is the nice little human moment. Still, it was nice of you to share in my distress.
Still,
it was kind of you to share in my distress. Thank you. Like, it's a very human moment there.
I love Paul's letters because there's so many of those little moments sprinkled through where you really get the feeling of it's a letter written by Paul to particular people. There's one letter, I can't remember which one it is off the top of my head, where he asks the recipient to send him his cloak and his scrolls that he left behind. I love that because it's like it's Paul, who's a person who's asking, by the way, send me some stuff. Send me my stuff that I left behind at your house.
What a great way of reminding us that scripture, the divine inspiration doesn't mean it was written down like a tome, like carved in rock. These are the Ten Commandments sort of thing. But it's inspiration is much more complicated than that because it's as much Paul is as much the author, or Matthew or Luke or John is as much the author as the Holy Spirit, that it says what they intend to say as well as what the Holy Spirit intends to say.
And Paul, at the time he was writing it, didn't realize that what he was reading would be put up on the same level as the book of Genesis. I mean,
the people will be reading my letters to Philemon
2,000 years
at their celebrations of the Eucharist.
I think that would have staggered Paul if he realized that letter that he was writing
I might have phrased some things differently.
Right?
The classic writer's regret. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So then the gospel is the wedding feast of the king's son, the classic one, which we always tend to focus on the guest who is cast out into the outer darkness.
Yeah, well, that's such a striking image.
Well, because we often feel like, well, that's not fair.
But, and it's disturbing. I mean, here's this great wedding feast, and then, like, instead of being able to dwell on the wonderful wedding feast, suddenly we're, like, being kicked out of the banquet with this guy.
Even before, The wedding feast begins with a slaughter of a city because they mistreat right. the king's servants. Right?
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of violence in this one.
So the king sends his servants out, just like in the vineyard, or you know, with the tenants, sends his servants out. Tell those who are invited, it's time. It's ready. Come, calves are fattened and killed. The cattle are killed. Come to the feast. And some ignored the invitation. The rest laid hold of his servants and mistreated and killed them. Like what? That doesn't make any sense, which is precisely the point, because that's what they did to the prophets.
Right.
The servants are the prophets.
And the wedding feast
is Jesus and the church.
Right. So here's the prophets trying to invite everybody into the wedding feast.
Those who've already been invited.
And right. those who are invited are killing them? Like, right. what a weird thing to just do.
Like the nation of Israel did to the prophets. And so he said, all right, so after he wipes out the city, it's like, hey, let's make sure we keep this party going. So he sends his servants out, just invite whoever's out you find out in the streets. Tell them to come. And so they do. The good and the bad alike, it says. But there was one guy not dressed in a wedding garment. And I think there was a specific context about the wedding garment. Like, this isn't just some guy who came in, you know, he didn't stop at the, you know, the Mr. Tux to get a tux. He just came in as he was invited. No, there was a very specific, like, it was a very specific kind of insult to show up without a particular way of being dressed. Like, you knew it. You, like, to do this was a very conscious act. Not merely an oversight.
Like, it's not just like the equivalent of showing up in flip-flops and Bermuda shorts to somebody's wedding.
Well, I mean, or to show up at like a royal wedding in flip-flops and Bermuda shorts. Like, that would be you have to be a special kind of dumb to not realize that would be inappropriate.
I see.
You know, I mean, it's like, that would be the king comes in, you know, or Queen Elizabeth comes in and says, bind that man up and cast him out.
Right. If you showed up to Prince Charles and Princess Diana's wedding wearing flip-flops and Bermuda shorts, I have a feeling that you would not be seated.
Oh, look at this one. Take him away. Off with his head. To the tower. But it is often like, bind his hands and feet, cast him into the darkness outside where there will be wailing and grinding of teeth. I don't think that's necessarily like casting into hell. I don't think. I think it's more just the wailing and grinding of teeth is the those who aren't invited, those who are on the outside of a really great party. It sounds like they're having fun in there. Oot, 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 oot. You know, you hear the rave going on, like, oot, oot, the bass from the DJ.
Is that what heaven's like?
Heaven is like, there's a rave. There's the awesome DJ inside.
Can I skip the part with the bass?
Oot, 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 oot.
Yeah, I hate that.
And then purgatory is the line waiting to get in.
Uh-huh.
And, like, hell, I guess, is the really awful club down the street. I don't know.
I think you've stretched this metaphor a little bit further than it wants to go.
That metaphor has stretched as far as it'll go. So anyway, Father Michael was the homilist today. He celebrated the Mass today. And in his homily, he talked about the wedding garment. And he kind of said the wedding garment, this is a paraphrase, I didn't get exactly what he said. The wedding garment for us is the fruit of the Holy Spirit that clothes us in grace. The Holy Spirit clothes us in grace. It is the life of virtue we are living. And so if we show up to the wedding feast without that garment, without that virtue, without that holiness, without the Holy Spirit in us, the life of the Holy Spirit, we are not dressed for the feast.
Right. And it's the actions and the life that we live, like living the life of the works of mercy and the work, a life of prayer and the sacraments and like all of those things. It's not just enough to be, he said, to be baptized and confirmed and go to Mass on Sunday. Like the sacraments aren't the fullness of Christian life.
Right. You have to live it. You have to be living the life. You have to be
following the commandments. You know, Jesus right. says, feed the hungry and give drink to the thirsty and clothe the naked. And if you just say, hey, have a nice day and
be well,
stay warm, but you don't actually give them a coat and they're freezing. You haven't fulfilled your obligation.
Right.
So there's a sense in which we have obligations that we have to fulfill in order to be living the Christian life. And if we blatantly ignore them, then and then expect to be able to show up at the wedding banquet like,
woohoo, I'm here.
I'm here.
Let me in. Nope, you're not wearing your wedding garment.
I think Father Michael specifically said, you know, not everyone who says Lord, Lord is welcome in the kingdom.
There was also the imagery of the mountaintop feast I like.
Oh, yeah.
So the wedding feast is in the mountaintop. And the, so the wedding feast is in the church. And the summit of the mountain, of that mountaintop where the feast takes place, is the altar. And the Eucharist is the source and summit of our faith. And is that feast. I love this mountaintop imagery that we get. And like, so when we're climbing the mountain together to the top, which is the altar where we receive the feast.
And so many of the Psalms have that image of, oh, let's go up to the house of the Lord. Like the idea of climbing the mountain is the way you get to the temple.
Right.
So that climbing the mountain, I mean, maybe that's why we continue to hold on to the idea of heaven as being up.
Yes.
Like, up in the sky, because there is this sense of ascent going up.
But also, it's hard. It's work. I mean, imagine if we always thought heaven was a place in a valley. Just descend into the valley. Oh, getting to heaven is easy. Just walk downhill. Oh, I'm just going downhill. No. Going to heaven, going to the feast, is up a mountain. You have to climb the mountain. It is work. It is hard.
But it's worth it.
Easy, but it's worth it. Right.
As anyone who's actually climbed a mountain knows, like, it is so hard. And then you get to the top and you look at the view and you're like, wow, this is so awesome. It was so worth it.
What is it? Is it the Carpenters? I'm on top of creation or top of the world looking down on creation.
No.
Okay, never mind. Sorry, a little 70s flashback there for you folks.
No.
We ought to wrap this up.
Yeah. We're getting punched.
A little punchy. Hey, yeah. We need an editor. We want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Charlene A., Brent P., Cameron S., Mike D., and Craig S. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. What did you think of our discussion? If you had any comments, you can let us know by going to sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com, and I'll put the relevant links from our discussion to the various things we talked about on our show notes at sqpn.com. You can be sure to subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the SQPN YouTube channel, where you should make sure to hit the bell to get notifications. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.